look at, we invented placement level pricing. We were the first ad system in the world that we knew of that had a separate and distinct price set for every placement on every page on every site.
Early to bed, early to rise, eat right and advertise. Early to bed, early to rise. And one more thing, get your name.
So this week we are very happy to welcome Mike Yavanditti to the program. Mike is currently CEO and founder of Yieldmo, an advertising platform. Back in 2002, Mike was CEO of a company called Quigo, which was a contextual ad network. Quigo was acquired by AOL in 2007 for a reported $340 million. Same year, AOL acquired the behavioral ad network Dakota from our previous guest, Dave Morgan. Before Quigo, Mike spent the dot-com boom and bust at various iconic players such as Juno and Alta Vista. Did you have entrepreneurs in your family? Was it a very entrepreneurial family? And where did this kind of startup impulse come from?
I did come from an entrepreneurial family. My father is a software engineer, and in the early 70s started writing code for mainframe computers. That code was used to manage, at one point, bill tracking systems for state governments, starting with New York State. And then as we were growing up in upstate New York, he taught my first cousin, his sister's son, how to write code when he was 15 years old. My cousin's name is Ray LaChance, and he's the founder and CEO of Link NYC. So Link NYC is the company that controls all the high-speed 5G network under New York City, all the kiosks and billboards that you see. In New York City, and you.
So it is in the family. What was your first venture then?
So it was actually with him. When we were both young and naive, he had at the time in the early 90s, he was building data centers for big companies like the New York Times and McGraw-Hill. And on the side, he had this. He took some of his capital and hired a few engineers and a few people and started tinkering around with the development of some push technology. We called it desktop news. I worked on that nights, weekends, whenever I had free time. Eventually, it was a news ticker. We actually made it ad supported and even found a couple of sponsors and tried to sell it to CNET. Halsey Miner even came and took a look and eventually passed on acquiring it, and about 6 months later launched his own version of the product.
You gave him an idea.
But I left there in late 94 and went to ZDNet or Ziff Davis. Yeah, so I ended up working there for 3 years, did very well. And then DE Shaw, the company that spawned Juno Online Services, incubated Juno, called me and recruited me from Ziff Davis. And so I ultimately went to DE Shaw, and then DE Shaw spun out this little company called Juno that they were incubating at the time. And a bunch of DE Shaw employees went with that spin out of Juno. And along with me came some of the best ad tech people in history of ad tech. Some of the noteworthy folks on that team were David Sasson, who was head of ad operations. David became the president of, was my SVP of operations at Quigo. It became president of Outbrain. Gokul Rajaram was one of the lead engineers on the Juno ad system. Gokul eventually went on to build Google AdSense and then the Facebook ad system. Matt Battles was one of the lead product managers on the Juno ad system. Matt went and became the head of product at A9 for Amazon advertising. And then Dave Jakubowski, who is an extraordinary advertising executive, joined me at Quigo, then went to Microsoft and ran their go-to-market strategy for Bing, and then ran measurement for Facebook and left about 5 years ago.
So can you remind our listeners what Juno did and what the ad experience was like on Juno?
Juno had a great ad system. It was a dial-up ISP and email service. It started as a dial-up email service. So think about an user experience similar to that of AOL at the time. You could dial into AOL and be in this new digital world that was really kind of amazing. With Juno, you could dial in and you would instead of dialing into this vast digital world, you were dialing into an email service that was quite rudimentary in the beginning, but became very robust over time. Yeah. And eventually they launched a free ISP. And so it was an email service with a lot of advanced capabilities. It was also an ISP, a free ISP. And in order to fund that, you had to build, you had to have some way of funding that free service. And so we built a very sophisticated, at the time, profile targeting system that was called the Juno ad system. And it looked remarkably similar to the Facebook ad system.
So it would take information that was surrendered by the users themselves about their age and interests.
So we had age, gender, location, marital status. I mean, those are really the big variables that 80% of the advertisers on Facebook key off of today. We had the most important demographic and psychographic variables on, you know, millions and millions of users. The problem was we didn't have anywhere near enough users. When you started to slice and dice that user base, it got small really fast.
Yeah. What did the ads look like? They were graphical ads?
The ads were graphical and they were very difficult to produce. I don't think, you know, sometimes they would take days or weeks. We had our own little almost like HTML language that we had to invent in order to create the ads. So the ads were, you know, the creation of the ads was a production and it created friction. However, because of the fact that they were delivered highly targeted to specific users of that email service, and because the ads showed up right in the interface of the email client, almost all of them were seen. Almost all of them were seen by almost all of the target, which is pretty fascinating if you think about it.
What happened to Juno?
Actually, it was one of the few companies that had a successful IPO in the 90s, got to a few hundred million a year in revenue, got to profitability, and then merged with Net Zero.
So you eventually made your way over to Alta Vista. How did that happen?
Yeah.
A popular search engine. It was a default for a while.
That was the big decision for me. And that's that's the decision that changed the trajectory of my career. Going from Juno, where I began my fascination with ad tech and advertising. At Alta Vista, that was just like pouring accelerant on my fascination because we had billions and billions of search queries that were occurring every month. We were at one point the dominant search engine. And, you know, if you have billions and billions of search queries coming in every month, you can do a lot of testing and experimentation. And that's why I fell in love with A/B testing and optimization and experimentation, which are really my areas of expertise.
What was your role at Alta Vista?
I was in like a business development, strategic partnerships role. I was someone who got heavily involved in all the big, at the time, the big $10, $20 million partnerships that you would sign with some advertiser that just raised a ton of money from an IPO and wanted a lot of traffic. And so we would cut these big search engine traffic deals. And there was always a challenge around how do you generate, someone's paying you $20 million and they want a lot of clicks from Alta Vista to their website. How do you get them a ton of clicks and how do you get them a lot of the right clicks? And so I actually became really fascinated with like, how do you do that? What do you put on the search results page when a human being types in the word car and they live in Illinois? What should the presentation layer look like on AltaVista.com on the homepage? And there were little teams working on all kinds of experiments and stuff. And so honestly, I spent a lot of my time with hovering around those teams, coming up with ideas and thinking about ways to make improvements. Hey, should we change fonts? And what would happen if we changed the font? And what would happen if we put a little picture of a car next to the first search result? And should the car be red or black? Should it be a Ferrari or a Mustang? And so we started making a lot of these changes. At first, it was because I wanted to help some big advertiser that just gave us $20 million. But it became, instead of it being, you know, this interest I had for one particular customer, it became my lifelong pursuit.
So at Alta Vista, was it a pay-per-click model for pricing?
We had two different methods of monetizing the search results pages. We did have pay-per-click ads on the search results pages. Ultimately, outsourced that to Overture, which I also worked on, that partnership. But we also had banner ads that were tied to keywords. And either one of those were highly effective. And so I understood the power of the connection between the user and the user intent and the thing you put on the page. And the power of that tight connection was cemented in my brain.
And the banners themselves, they ran on the top of the page? Like a
they
typical
did,
banner?
Yes. Oh, that's right.
Were you in New York, by the way?
No, I was in Palo Alto.
Oh.
So I moved to Palo Alto, which is why it became a big thing for me, because I got to know a lot of the folks that, frankly, run a lot of the companies today.
This was during the height of the dot-com boom.
This is 99 to 2001.
Yeah, the boom and the bust. You experienced both. What was your experience of that era? Was it shockingly traumatic and emotional or not so much?
I was kind of amazed when I got to Alta Vista that they were, I was amazed at all the things they were trying to do, and a little bit too young and naive at the time to know that instead of being amazed at all the things they were trying to do, I should have been upset or appalled.
Alarmed.
It ended up being the reason why they lost their way.
Yeah.
So the reason why Alta Vista doesn't exist anymore, in my opinion, is because CMGI had bought them. They had grand aspirations to be more like Yahoo like what they were. And had they just stayed in their lane and built, you know, a much better search engine and a much better search ad system, I think they would still be in existence in some iteration, or at least they would have lasted a lot longer than they did.
Well, everyone wanted to be Yahoo in those days. This was sort of
pre-Google and AOL. Right.
That's right. Andor, yeah.
Everyone had Portal Envy.
Portal Envy. I recall it well. So around 2001, I know CMGI was going to be an IPO, I guess, canceled, or were you?
They ended up canceling the IPO. And so that was my impetus for leaving Alta Vista. I knew the market was imploding. And I also knew that I wanted to stay somewhere on the internet. I didn't have any interest in leaving. So I packed my bags up one day and flew back to New York, and I kept my apartment the whole time in New York City, and got a call one day to meet a couple of guys from Israel who were working on this very interesting set of technologies, very advanced web crawling technologies that they were trying to sell to the Israeli Defense Force. And I went and met those folks, and that meeting ultimately turned into Quigo, us building Quigo.
So when you talk to these guys, Israeli founders, how did they pitch their idea to you? What did they tell you they were building?
They positioned it as the most advanced web crawler ever built.
Okay.
I had some experience with web crawlers and search engines previously, which made me somewhat relevant to the conversation. I saw what they were doing and was kind of blown away by it. They had a web crawler that was using machine learning at that time. This was in 2001, 2002, and they were able to point that web crawler at, say, an Amazon, and very quickly crawl that site and find almost every page on Amazon.com, whereas at the time, Alta Vista could not do that. And so when I understood that discrepancy was real and significant, I thought that we could do something with that technology. And so I decided to become CEO of this little company.
How big was it when at the time?
Like 3 or 4 people, like that.
Okay. So you were the CEO, but you could have the company in a room, right? In a conference room.
Yeah. And they were in Israel at the time.
Okay. So they weren't even there. Okay.
We eventually changed what we were planning on doing. They wanted to sell technology to the government. Mm-hmm. Eventually I said, no, it needs to be pointed in a direction that's more, I think, relevant to the web and to consumers. And so we turned it into a product that could be used for early on search engine marketing, where we could crawl retailer websites and push pages automatically into the search engines, which we did. And then we turned that technology into, I think, one of the best ad systems ever built. And I can kind of tell you how I got there.
Yeah, I'd love to hear that. Is that the ad sonar you're talking about?
Get your name out there.
When you crawl the web and you want to take a document and submit it to the search to a search engine, the one thing that you must have in order to make that document relevant to that search engine is you must have keywords, right? So you must have keywords that are appended to that page. And so if you're crawling Amazon.com and Amazon has a million pages, that means you need to generate keywords for a million pages, which means you have to have some ability to do semantic analysis on those pages. And so embedded in this incredible web crawler that we were building, that we did build, we also had very sophisticated semantic analysis technology. I went and showed that technology to AltaVista. I showed it to Overture. I showed it to Yahoo. Overture ultimately tried to buy us because at the same time that Overture was interested in it, they had a design to compete against Google AdSense. Right. AdSense had bought Applied Semantics. Google bought Applied Semantics. So Overture and Yahoo no longer had Applied Semantics as an option for using their technology to compete against Google. And so we became the company that they were interested in. So I eventually broke out that semantic targeting technology that was embedded in the web crawler and turned around and licensed it to Overture and to Yahoo and helped them compete against AdSense. So that's a little piece of ad tech history that most people don't know.
That's pretty cool. And so when you say semantic analysis, so this would be, it scans the page and it would kind of pull out the important keyword. It would be able to tell how to summarize that page in a few
keywords. Correct. The list of keywords that you spit out really matter in terms of relevancy and accuracy. It matters to the ultimate customer. You could get 10 really smart teams all working on the same problem, and you will get 10 different outputs from each one of those teams. It's a very difficult thing to do extremely well.
So what were the products then? So you had two different products at Quigo?
Yeah, we had this crawler product that would go after all the retailer websites, crawl their site, generate keywords, and then spit them out into the search engines. And that was a nice little business. But then we broke out the semantic technology and licensed it to Overture and Yahoo. Eventually, we went back to those companies and said, look, you're not using the technology in the way we think you should be using it. And we think there's a better way to compete against Google. And we don't see you guys as being those companies. So we're going to build our own stack of technology and we're going to compete against Google. And of course, they all laughed at us and said, good luck. No. But that's exactly what we did. We took the technology back and we built a full stack of technology and started competing against AdSense. And ultimately, I think became the second player in that space for all intents and purposes at a time when we really had no business being in that position.
So who were your customers then for the second phase?
Publishers and advertisers. So we went and we took a lot of the premium publishers from Google and Yahoo. Time Inc., all of Time Inc., CNN, Fox News, ESPN. I mean, these are the number one gets in advertising. And that was, if you recall, that was when Google was writing big checks to publishers and saying, if you take our check, you can't work with Yahoo, Microsoft. And guess who else was on that list? Quigo. We were literally written into the contracts. I remember when I found that out, it was scary. But we were one.
You knew you had made it.
We were one of the companies listed.
Yeah.
And they would even go at the time, they would, when they found out we were talking to Fox News or ESPN, they would go and offer them a lot more money. It got to the point where our system worked so much better than AdSense that it didn't matter how much money they were willing to overpay. We were still generating a much bigger check.
So how did you ultimately differentiate from AdSense?
You know, our system worked in a very different way.
Yeah.
Google was auctioning off keywords on AdWords, and then those advertisers would ultimately show up on a page on ESPN that related that to that keyword. What I did was I sort of flipped the script and I said to ESPN, instead of, you know, if an advertiser spends 30 cents per click for the key phrase New England Patriots, and then that advertiser shows up on your site, you're getting 60% of 30 cents. You're getting whatever, 18 cents or whatever. ESPN, that the New England Patriots pages are worth a lot more than 18 cents. in a year where the New York Patriots or the New England Patriots won the Super Bowl, maybe their pages are worth $2 a click, not 18 cents a click. What if I could auction off every individual ad placement on every individual page as a distinct object, like Google auctions off keywords? What if I auctioned off your pages as objects? And what if I set a separate price for every one of those distinct objects? So if you have a million pages on ESPN.com, I'm going to create a million separate prices. And everyone at the time said to me, that's crazy. That doesn't scale. And I said, well, I think it will. I said, we just have to do it one publisher at a time. And that's what we did. And so we would sign one publisher and then the next and then the next. And ultimately, we signed hundreds of publishers and they were all exclusive.
So you had they had more granular controls over the inventory, it sounds like.
And then we brought in.
They could have with AdSense. Yeah.
And then this is where it connects to AltaVista. Yeah. And so then I said to my team, hey, what would happen if we allowed advertisers to run A/B testing experiments on each individual page and give them performance analysis and let them know, all right, creative A is working really well on all the New England Patriots pages, but creative B is working best on the Pittsburgh Pirates pages and so on and so forth. So every little page that had a separate price became its own marketplace. And we started building testing and optimization tools that allowed us to make that easy to do. And then the big seminal event for us was we launched a product called Aesthetic Yield Optimization. That was my first patent where, remember, Google had a system that allowed publishers to go in and they could create their own little template, pick their own font and the color of the font and all that kind of stuff. And they could, well, I said to my team, hey, what would happen if we used machine learning to make the choices instead of the publisher? And we brought it to Fox News and we started running experiments with this very sophisticated at the time A/B testing system. It would pick fonts and it would test like borders and no borders and the thickness of the fonts and the boldness of the fonts and all these sorts of things. And it knew it could run a lot of experiments on high traffic pages and smaller number experiments on lower traffic pages. When we launched that, our click-through rate increased by about 300% and our revenue followed. And I remember one day getting a call from Jeremy Steinberg at Fox News, and they said, they had just turned Google off and turned us on. And they said, you must come over to Sixth Avenue right away. We need to talk to you. And of course, I thought they were going to shut us off. And they said, what the hell are you guys doing? We're looking at the revenue and we're trying to forecast next year for Roger Ailes. And your revenue's up so much above where Google was when we last had Google on that no one believes that you can sustain these numbers. You're like 200% above Google. How is this possible? What are you guys doing?
So what year was Aesthetic Yield Optimization?
2004.
Okay. So then how fast did you guys grow? Did you become very big very quick? How did that work?
We grew very fast, ultimately sold the company to AOL in 2007.
Yeah.
On the heels of signing all of Time Inc. So we signed all of Time Inc.'s publishers, which kind of forced AOL's hand. When we sold the company, it was Yahoo and AOL bidding.
Yeah.
AOL paid the most, so we sold to AOL. And then it became the brand Quigo went away, but Quigo became part of advertising.com and didn't get shut down until like 2017. So it was a meaningful, it was a meaningful part of advertising.com's revenue and profits for all those years. It became extraordinarily successful. Ad.com and Quigo were among the two most successful acquisitions AOL has ever made. Quigo was maybe even more financially successful than any of the others because it was such a good system. They never had to rebuild it, and they could turn it onto all their traffic and all their publishers, partners' traffic, and it just worked, and it worked extremely well.
Yeah. So I know that was a big year, 2007. AOL acquired you guys, they acquired Takoda. They already had ad.com, I think.
That's correct.
And you mentioned that Quigo was a successful part of that. How did they, to the extent you understand it, AOL's overall strategy to compete at that time with Google and Yahoo, how did Quigo fit into that?
AdSense was taking up a lot of inventory on publishers and creating risk for advertising.com. And so if advertising.com could go to a publisher and say, hey, we bring all this monetization to you, and now we have Quigo, now all of a sudden they're a lot more important to that publisher.
I see.
So I think it was as simple as that.
Added capability. What happened to you at that point? Did you stay for a bit or did you leave?
I transitioned to a consultant position, but didn't really have an active role. I did not stay on in an operational position. My wife and I had a baby, and I started doing some angel investing.
Yeah.
And invested in a number of companies, some ad companies, and joined a couple boards and tried a few other things that were not ad related, as many of us tend to want to do after we sell a company. We want to try something very different and ultimately get sucked back into advertising because it's the only thing we're good at.
So it brings us to Yieldmo, which is your current endeavor. So what opportunity did you identify with Yieldmo? And I can already see the themes of testing and optimization, and although maybe in more of a mobile format. But how did
Yieldmo happen? Yeah, and I knew that when the smartphone launched, it was obvious to us, or to me, that new formats would have to be invented, developed, which to me meant there needed to be a lot of testing to figure out the right aesthetic should be. And so in 2012, when I decided I finally had the courage to go back into advertising, I got together with a couple of my ex-folks from Quigo, and I said, hey, there has to be a whole new tech stack developed for this new device. It's going to take a ton of technology, a lot of testing and experimentation. Everyone's so obsessed with programmatic. I don't know that a lot of people are going to build testing systems and measurement systems and all the things that you might have to build in order to test new types of ad formats. And so we decided that we were going to do that and then ultimately merge it into the programmatic world. And so we started building our own little ad server. We started building formats. We started building like a little testing framework. Ultimately, within the first year or two, we started building a little baby measurement system that would look kind of like Moat or IAS or Double Verify. And we started as an ad network, to be honest with you. A very technological driven, optimization driven ad network.
You are known for creative templates. I know that. And ad formats, I remember over the years, like a scroller and certain things. What are some of your best known?
Actually, that format I predicted when we invented it. We invented what's called the hyper scroller. As an idea, it's been borrowed quite a bit. The borrowers don't know that we have 5 patents issued on that format alone.
What does the hyper scroller look like?
Yeah, it kind of fits into a 300 by 250. And the idea behind the hyper scroller was if you could figure out where a human being was on a page relative to where the ad tag was and relative to where the ad was in the viewable window, could you predict when a user was coming upon that ad in the viewable window? And could you actually use motion to capture their attention? That was the direction I gave our designers. We hired a couple of world-class designers early on out of IDEO who were mechanical engineers and said, I want you to experiment with motion as a user comes upon an ad in the viewable window and let's see what we can come up with. And they came up with a whole class of formats that create the illusion that a user is controlling the animation in an ad when in fact they are not. And then because we wanted to try to measure how is it if a human feels like they're controlling frames of animation in an ad, will that cause them to scroll up and down past the ad and cause them to maybe feel like they're playing with the ad?
So today at Yieldmo, what are you investing in? What are you most focused on?
About 4 or 5 years ago, because we were building this measurement system and we went from measuring not just how someone scrolls up and down past the hyperscroller, but we started collecting hundreds of other things that people do not collect. We woke up one day and realized that we were collecting trillions and trillions of events every month, and that we had a significant machine learning opportunity that others didn't have. Yeah. And so about four to five years ago, we started building a data engineering team. We built a very sophisticated real-time data infrastructure, like one people maybe wish they could build. We actually spent tens of millions of dollars and about 3 years actually building a real-time data infrastructure. We stood up Snowflake. We started bringing in all this really interesting data. A lot of it was attention related. And so a lot of our work over the last 4 or 5 years is, how do you take this novel, massively scaled, novel data set and turn that into machine learning models that improve outcomes? And so our mission has been to perfect what people call curation, inventory curation. So we have two different parts
matching,
of the system.
Matching the inventory and the creative. I see.
So one part of the system, and it's all, and we have separate models for every KPI.
Yeah.
So one part of the system is suggesting the right supply based on your KPI and format type. And then we have another system that's newer, that's about a year old, that uses machine learning to pick the right version of the right creative down to the ad slot level.
The last question I have for you is just about this year and the next year. Do you have any predictions in the space or any thoughts about things that might happen?
It's the murkiest time.
That's what I think.
in my career, the poorest visibility ever. So I'm not going to make any bold predictions other than I believe it will slowly thaw out over the next 6 months. And I hope we get to a more normal state by the end of the year. That's my prediction and my hope.